whose assets are frozen and who are not allowed to enter EU countries. The EU says those officials were involved in human rights violations stemming from the presidential elections in 2010. President Alexander Lukashenko ordered mass arrests of people who protested alleged fraud in that election. Germany's foreign minister denounced the Belarusian government as the last dictatorship in Europe. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Moscow.
President Obama welcomes about 200 Iraq War veterans to the White House for a formal dinner tonight. He joins a host of other presidents in personally honoring war vets, this time the more than 1 million troops who served in Iraq. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to protect photos, music, and other computer files from loss. Details at carbonite.com.
Are electric cars the wave of the future? And will they save us money? Revenge of the Electric Car, our next community cinema, follows the race to be the first, the most exhilarating, and the fastest to break the world's addiction to fossil fuels. The free public screening is at the main Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, March 6th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film is closed caption and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter.
Today's programs are made possible by the Farmer City Antiques Merchants, presenting the 18th Annual Farmer City Antique Show on Saturday, March 3rd from 10 to 5 and Sunday, March 4th from 11 to 4 at the Blue Ridge High School in Farmer City. More information is at 217-356-3902.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Today, both programs come to you from the Focus Archives. The first, a show that we originally broadcast in early January of this year. So as you listen during this first hour of Focus, do keep in mind that we will not take calls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. And our guest for the program is Jim Newton. He's a journalist who works for the Los Angeles Times, and he is also the author of a new biography of Eisenhower. The title of the book is Eisenhower, the White House Years, and it's published by Doubleday. I think that there are a lot of people who, when they think of Eisenhower, they think of a man who certainly was a great general, instrumental in the Allied victory in World War II, but as a president, perhaps only average. However, our guest, Jim Newton, says that Eisenhower's performance as president has been greatly underappreciated. He says that Eisenhower was a man who was both shrewd and tempestuous. He was a meticulous manager. He was unbound by partisanship, and he was a military man who was also a champion of peace. So in this hour, we'll be talking about America's 34th president with Jim Newton. And Jim Newton, hello.
It's a pleasure. Morning to you.
Hey, well, thank you very much for giving us your time. We certainly do appreciate it. You know, I think that as people think about Eisenhower and his period, I'm sure there are a lot of people who think about the 50s as being something where not a lot of interesting or important things happened. And I think it doesn't take very long, though, if you take a look at the 1950s, you realize that there were some really potent and powerful domestic and international issues going, and that certainly the 50s is not a bland time. And yet I think we think of it that way, and we think of Eisenhower as being really an exemplar of that. You know, I think the phrase I used in my promo that is, a lot of people think that he was a bland man for a bland time. Why is it you think that we have that idea of the 50s?
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I guess my theory on why the 50s as a period, I think, are somewhat overlooked, are that they fall between World War II and the sort of social and cultural upheaval of the 1960s. And so it seems like sort of a respite between those two monumental events. And then the other fact of the 50s, I think, is because there wasn't a great world war during that period. Again, it seems like a sort of a period of quietude. But I think that does a real injustice to the period. It is the rise of the civil rights movement. It's a period of enormous geopolitical conflict, the Cold War, of course, conflicts in Southeast Asia. The Korean War began in the 1950s, and Eisenhower ended it soon into his presidency. And the fact that there wasn't a world war is sometimes, I think, people regard it as the evidence of Eisenhower's blandness, that there wasn't that kind of geopolitical conflict on that scale. In fact, I would argue that it's a tribute to his presidency that he kept the peace through such a tense and difficult period.
Yeah, and I think that you definitely make the argument that he was, here was someone who had nuclear weapons at his disposal, and there were people who were arguing that there might have been circumstances when they should have been used, and he was always very strong and steadfast in saying no.
Indeed. It's important to remember he's the first American president to have a nuclear weapon and not use it. Harry Truman, of course, inherited the Manhattan Project and used atomic bombs to end the Second World War in Asia. And many of Ike's advisors counseled him to use nuclear weapons to end the war in Korea. It was utterly plausible, in fact, in some ways natural, that we would do so. And imagine if you're a parent in that period and you have a son or a daughter in the Korean War, and you know that your government has a weapon that could bring the war to a rapid conclusion. You can understand why there was significant political and military pressure to use those weapons, not only to end that war, but then to resolve conflicts. China periodically shelled Taiwan during the period, and many of Ike's advisors urged him to wage war to bring that to a conclusion. The French begged him to use military force to rescue the French garrison at Dien Bien Phu in Indochina during that conflict. The Soviets threatened to turn Berlin over to East Germany later in the Eisenhower presidency. In all of those conflicts, the prospect of military force, use of military force, was quite realistic, and the use of nuclear weapons also quite plausible.
Mm. Overall, I think, I'm going back to this idea that maybe people think that he was not a particularly exciting or charismatic man, that it seems to be the case that he really had this idea that it was important for him to strike a kind of relaxed, not crisis-oriented tone in his life and in his presidency, and that the idea would be that the country would get the idea that, basically things were okay. That is, by giving out the signal that there was no crisis really in the White House, the idea was that the American people would look at that and say, well, there's really no crisis in the country.
Mm-hmm. He believed, and this, I think, goes to his conservatism. I mean, one of the premises of my book, and I think an accurate reading of his presidency, is to discover that he was a far more progressive figure than people gave him credit for at the time. But one aspect of his real fundamental conservatism is that he really did believe that the American people were genuinely peace-loving and prosperity-seeking people who would do the right thing if left alone by their government. And he believed that the FDR and Truman had intentionally cultivated a sense of crisis for political purposes, that it helped to rally people to their support. And Ike was offended by that and really believed that instead the government should do as little as it needed to do in order to advance prosperity and peace, to do what was necessary for those things, but not to do it, not to cultivate a sense of crisis. So, our image of him, I think many people's image of him as sort of a golfing, loafing, detached president, in part, for his health, he did in fact need to vacation, and he did. He had a heart attack in 1955 and needed to watch his health. But he also intentionally drew attention to his vacationing and his leisure, in part because he really did believe that the government shouldn't be an omnipresent in people's lives, but people should feel a sense of ability to relax and not feel bound by crisis.
Yeah. Something else, and you just kind of touched on it, and I think it's interesting because it says something about how maybe our ideas about age have changed. When he was nominated, he was 62, and that there were a lot of people that were very concerned about that and said, well, this guy's an old man, and is it really a good idea to have somebody of that age to be serving as president?
Yeah, that was a big issue, particularly in the 1956 campaign when he ran for re-election, because, as I mentioned, he did have a heart attack in 55. He was out of office for over 3 months, which is pretty staggering to imagine in today's presidency.
Yeah.
And his vice president was Richard Nixon, who was a very controversial figure even then. And so when Stevenson, he ran against Stevenson twice for the presidency and obviously beat him twice. But in the 1956 campaign, Stevenson very deliberately ran against Nixon, who was a much more polarizing figure than Eisenhower, but with the intimation that Eisenhower might not live through his second term and that the nation, therefore, was effectively electing Nixon president. It didn't work, obviously. Ike was resoundingly reelected. But his health was a point of considerable debate, in that, particularly in that campaign.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour is Jim Newton. He works for the Los Angeles Times. He is the author of a new biography of Dwight Eisenhower. The title is Eisenhower, the White House Years, and it's published by Doubleday. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to before talking a little bit about the campaign, and I'm interested in having you talk about Eisenhower and Nixon and their relationship. While the book primarily does indeed concentrate on the time when Eisenhower was president, you do have some information there about his growing up and his military career. And I think that you've really said that if you want to try to understand Dwight Eisenhower as president, you really need to know something about who this man was and what his experiences were before he came to the White House, perhaps even before he became a military man for his career. He certainly was not a child of wealth or privilege. He grew up in Kansas. Are there some ways in which you think that background as a true Midwesterner was important in setting his values?
Unquestionably, and it is why, before entering the White House years proper in the book, why I felt it important to step back and address that period, and, of course, his military life as well. Yeah, I think a part of his a real common touch, he really did have a knack for leading people. And I think a lot of that comes from growing up in a home. He's one of six brothers. He grew up in a home that was smaller than his office when he was chief of staff of the U.S. Army. So there is a real modesty about his upbringing. His family were pacifists, and in fact, his brother Milton would said later in life that the only time he ever heard his mother cry was when she put Dwight Eisenhower on the train for West Point. So he grew up in a sort of an unusual background for a man who would then become a military leader and ultimately a political leader. His brothers were very varied in their interests. One was a banker, one was a pharmacist, one was an academic, one was a lawyer. So there was a real sense of learning and dedication to education, of helping one another. And I think a lot of that manifested itself, as I say, first in his military life and later in his political life.
Well, given that within his family there was this strong value placed on pacifism, his mother particularly, how is it that he ended up going into the military for his career?
Yeah, it is really one of those great little happenstance moments of American history. Really the only reason or the real motivation for Eisenhower to go to West Point was the fact that it was free. He was studying. He had a friend named Sweet Hazlitt, who was a lifelong friend. He was a friend throughout the president, almost to the end of the presidency when Hazlitt died. They studied together for the entrance exams. Eisenhower actually was interested in applying to Annapolis, but it turned out he was too old for Annapolis by the time his application was complete. West Point allowed students to come in who were slightly older, so he was accepted at West Point and attended. But it really wasn't the draw of a military life so much as it was the draw of quality and cheap education.
Yeah, and it seems that there at West Point, he was, I don't know, the one would say he was a particularly distinguished student. No. He was not one of the worst that ever graduated from West Point, but he was not top of his class kind of guy. And it seems that really the important things that he learned were things that he learned after his commission, and they were the result of relationships with older, more experienced military men.
Absolutely right. Ike is probably best remembered at West Point for being what's called a sentry man, which is someone who had so many demerits that he spent over 100 hours having to march them off in the yard. So, no, his academic career is not what propelled him to greatness. But yes, he had an uncanny knack for attracting high-quality mentors, and it's hard to know what to attribute that to. But in his post-West Point life, he was associated with a number of very important generals. In some ways, the most important, I think, is a very little-known general by the name of Fox Connor. Connor was one of the great talent scouts of the United States Army between the wars. And he met Eisenhower through Patton, who was another a friend and mentor, and was quite taken with him. And he invited Eisenhower to come join him in Panama, where he was stationed at the time, and put him through just a long, effectively, a tutorial. And some of the academic learning that I sort of skipped at West Point, Fox Connor really imposed on him during their time in Panama. He would give him military classics, Clausewitz and the like, have him read them and then grill him about them. They would ride together and talk about the military classics. And by the time Ike was done in Panama, he was, and Connor had really given him his blessing, he was on a new trajectory within the military. Connor encouraged him to apply to the command school at Fort Leavenworth. Eisenhower got in. Eisenhower was very worried that he wouldn't do well, but Connor assured him that the tutorial that he'd been putting him through had prepared him well. And not only did he do well at the command school, he graduated first in his class there. From that point on, he was clearly bound for something important within the military. And then the final, the really important mentor to him is General Marshall, who spotted him, had spotted him early. Marshall used to keep a book with a list of prospective generals. And after Pearl Harbor, he called Eisenhower to Washington and ultimately, of course, put him on the track to lead the American or to lead the Allied forces in Europe.
Well, given that, though, that he was certainly, after the war, was widely admired around the world and recognized for that fact of leading the Allies, that it seems odd that what he did, the first thing after coming home after the war, was he became a university president.
Yeah, not his most distinguished stop in his career. He used to joke that, as I mentioned, Milton Eisenhower, his youngest brother, was a very distinguished academic, went on to become the president of Johns Hopkins and other educational institutions. He was, a really esteemed academic. And Dwight Eisenhower, the president, used to joke that he assumed that the trustees at Columbia had offered it to the wrong Eisenhower and then were too embarrassed to withdraw the offer when he accepted. He spent a couple years at Columbia. Was not terribly well regarded by the faculty, didn't enjoy the fundraising aspects of it. He did not compile a great record at Columbia and didn't like it much and was readily summoned back to the National Service when Truman asked him to become the first head of NATO in Europe. So it is a brief and not terribly distinguished interlude in his life. Mm-hmm.
Certainly, when things that we know about him is that his bid for office was very successful, to say the least. He won in a landslide. Again, though, it's interesting that he, at least at first, it seemed that he wasn't exactly sure that he wanted it, whether he either wanted to be the candidate or maybe he wanted to be president.
Right. In 48, there's an extraordinary moment. Of course, he runs as successfully as he said in 52. In 48, Truman actually offered to step down and run as his vice president if he would be the Democratic nominee for president. There was some uncertainty since, because in his military life he had no political involvement, people didn't know whether he was a Republican or Democrat. And Truman assumed he was a Democrat because of his close relationship with FDR during the war, but that was just not the case. And then in 52, he was somewhat reluctantly persuaded to run, and partly he was persuaded to run because he believed Truman had badly mishandled the lead-up to the Korean War. He was worried about America's engagement with the world. And then he was concerned on the other side, that on the Republican side, that Taft, who was an isolationist, was a leading candidate for president, and Ike very much worried about the idea of America's withdrawal from its alliances. And then a long shot but still plausible candidate was Douglas MacArthur, who Truman had fired as the commanding general in Korea at that point. Ike knew MacArthur all too well. Ike had spent many years as an adjutant to MacArthur and was quite alarmed at the prospect of him becoming president. Ike used to refer to his time with MacArthur as a study in theatrics. MacArthur was the opposite of the kind of leader that Ike believed in. Instead of a subdued leader who would, delegate to subordinates and lead by example, he was a histrionic, theatrical, overbearing presence. And Ike was really alarmed about the notion that he might be president. So part of his candidacy was defensive to try to head off candidates who he thought would be bad for the country.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Jim Newton. He is editor at large at the Los Angeles Times, writes a weekly column for the paper, is the author of a new biography of Dwight Eisenhower, concentrating on his White House years. It is published by Doubleday. Questions welcome. We have somebody here ready to go, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller, Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. In your preface or whatever, your idea about Ike's attitudes towards nuclear weapons, you incorporated the commonplace in American culture, which ought to be debunked by now, that the nuke use in Japan was involved in ending the war earlier. I actually didn't believe that. Garel Powerowitz, who wrote the book on this so many years ago, it actually cites Ike's concerns about the nuclear use against Japan and was very vociferous about how stupid he thought it was and unnecessary. So there's that. I think that I haven't heard anything about the legacy of the Iran coup, which happened under Ike. There was a coup in Guatemala. The end of Eisenhower's term included setting up the attack on Cuba, which the Kennedys are accused of having operated poorly. But it was a fiasco from its planning stages only on. And to cut to the end of the Eisenhower presidency, he had great misgivings about, the so-called military-industrial complex and how much power they had, limiting the operational space that a president can have. And so I know that's at the end of the presidency, but I'd like for you to comment on perhaps those three things.
The caller's given us enough to go the whole rest of the show. let's do that. Maybe we could take them in order. Can you say something about Eisenhower's thinking about the use of the nuclear bomb on Japan?
Yeah, first of all, the caller's absolutely right, and I certainly didn't mean to imply otherwise. Eisenhower, although not involved in the decision to bomb Japan, because he was involved in the European theater, had grave misgivings about the use of it to end the war. I think that all that I said earlier was that Truman had used the weapon to end the war. I hadn't tried to comment on Ike's role or views on any of that. With respect to the coups, there's no question but that the most controversial and pernicious aspect of the Eisenhower foreign policy legacy is in its enthusiastic embrace of covert action. In 1953, the Eisenhower administration and Ike himself authorized the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran. In 54, it did the same with Arbenz in Guatemala. And there's no question but that those two actions had profound ramifications, indeed still have profound ramifications for American foreign policy. They were much emulated by presidents who came after Eisenhower as well. All that one can say, I think, about it in defense of it, and I don't mean to defend it because I do think it was an extremely negative aspect of the presidency, but Eisenhower and they were looking for a way to check communism in those days without a frontal confrontation that could result in a nuclear confrontation. Covert action seemed to them and to Ike himself to offer an alternative way to protect American interests and to do so at minimal risk of American life. But it did, one thing to remember about the Iran and Guatemalan episodes is that in each instance, they're just the unintended consequences are enormous. In Iran, among those who was offended by the American action in Iran was Khomeini, of course, who comes to power and sets a whole new era in Middle Eastern and international politics. And in Guatemala, among those who was on the ground and offended by American actions was Che Guevara, who goes on, of course, to the revolution in Cuba. The one place I would take a little bit of issue is with respect to the Bay of Pigs. It is true that the Eisenhower administration began the planning for the Bay of Pigs. Eisenhower never did authorize the invasion at the Bay of Pigs. He was not convinced at the end of his administration that it was a viable approach for overthrowing Castro. He was perfectly willing to see Castro gone, he didn't have a moral objection to the use of force in Cuba, but he didn't think it was ready. And when Kennedy did authorize it, and it failed miserably, he actually met with Eisenhower and acknowledged sort of ruefully that he had badly mishandled it, which he did.
Yeah, let's save the military-industrial complex for a little bit later in the conversation. And I have another caller I hear want to get to. I guess I just though think it's worth, particularly in these two cases, of underlining that I think they provide ample administration that people around the world in countries where we have meddled have much longer memories than we do, and that particularly with the case of Iran, the coup in 1953, that was something that would come back to haunt the United States a quarter century later, And it was something certainly that the Iranians remembered. And by that time, you know, by that time of the Iranian Revolution, something that a lot of Americans had forgotten, even though it wasn't all that. It was a couple of administrations back, but it wasn't all that long.
There's no question about it. And I think, you know, arguably, the United States continues to pay a price for its role in the overthrow of Mossadegh. So it is an important and painful reminder that covert action, while appealing in the short run, has implications that really reverberate long and loud over time.
Right. Let's talk with someone else here. Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Newton.
Hi.
Please discuss General Eisenhower's view on civil rights for African-American soldiers during World War II and civil rights in general for African-Americans during his administration. Thank you.
Okay.
Another excellent and huge topic. Eisenhower grew up in segregated Kansas, served in a segregated military, and thus, at the time he became president, had never served under a black man, much less a black woman, or even regarded one as an equal, as a peer in his professional life. I do think he came to the presidency with real blinders as a result to the moral urgency of segregation. He believed very strongly in what he called the middle way, in trying to find a middle ground between extreme positions on most issues. It was a guiding principle, again, going back to his growing up. I think it's no accident, it's no coincidence that he is the middle brother in this very diverse family. It comes naturally to him. It came naturally to him to seek a middle way. And in most issues, I think that served him fairly well. It was not the case in civil rights. I think in civil rights, he did not recognize that there was not a central position between segregationists and those who were clamoring for civil rights. His middle way, his preferred idea, was that the country would move slowly and eventually adopt. I mean, he was not a racist, so he believed that equal rights for blacks was ultimately important, but he didn't see the rush to do it. Where I think the country is lucky is that he also had a principle that I mentioned earlier, which is he believed very strongly in delegating to subordinates. And his subordinate who took the lead on these issues was his Attorney General, Herbert Brownell. And the result of that is that Eisenhower actually compiled a very successful record on civil rights, even when his instincts weren't so good. He appointed Earl Warren, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, of course. He later appointed William Brennan, another great champion of civil rights. His other three nominees to the court, he named five justices to the court, although more conservative than Warren or Brennan, also consistently voted to uphold Brown versus the Board of Education and the subsequent civil rights decisions of the Warren Court. He secured passage of the 1957 Civil Rights Act, which was the first, although a modest act, it was the first act since Reconstruction adopted by Congress. And, of course, in some ways most famously, he authorized the dispatch of the 101st Airborne in order to protect the nine black students at Little Rock High School when Governor Faubus tried to prevent them from attending school as they were constitutionally entitled to do. Mm-hmm. So his record on civil rights is impressive. His instincts on it were limited, I would say.
I think the Little Rock case I'm interested in, and this is, again, going to be one of the things that people will remember him for, the fact that he federalized the Arkansas National Guard and sent in the 101st Air troops of the 101st Airborne to escort the students into Little Rock, the Central High School there. And I think people remember that as being a very important event, and certainly was a very important event in the struggle for civil rights. In his particular case, though, I think you point out that he didn't agree with the Brown decision, didn't think that the Supreme Court had done the right thing, and seemed in this case to be as much motivated by concerns over the rule of law and keeping the peace as anything else.
Indeed. I wouldn't quite say that he disagreed with the Brown decision. He was reluctant to have his administration accredited with it.
Mm-hmm.
He was quite concerned that Brown would force a more rapid desegregation than he thought the country could handle. His great concern with respect to Brown was that Southern segregationist school districts would close, that they would close schools rather than integrate them. And by the way, that turned out to be correct. In many instances, many schools did close rather than integrate. So some of his fears were justified with respect to Brown. But yes, you're absolutely correct that when it came time to use force in Little Rock, what motivated Eisenhower principally was that if a southern governor, if a governor of any state is allowed to use federal troops, National Guard troops, in order to thwart the orders of a federal court, in this case the United States Supreme Court, and the district court that was ordering the implementation of Brown and Little Rock, then federal authority has effectively ended. That's anarchy or civil war. And if Eisenhower understood anything perfectly, it was the use, the appropriate use of military force and how to use it well. He was not going to allow, he could not afford to allow a governor to defy federal authority. So when Faubus chose to do so, Eisenhower showed him who was boss. And it's possible, had that confrontation come over some other issue other than civil rights, it's possible that he would have been obliged to use force in precisely the same way. What is certainly the case, however, here is that whatever his private views and personal views on civil rights, he was unwilling to allow a Southern governor to defy federal authority on civil rights. And so in the end, he did enforce it, and it's, of course, worth noting that no governor ever tested him that way again.
The guest in this hour focus is Jim Newton. He's a veteran journalist, worked for the New York Times, also the Atlanta Constitution. Right now he's at the LA Times, where he is editor-at-large and author of a weekly column. He is the author of a book about Chief Justice Earl Warren, Justice for All, Earl Warren and the Nation He Made. That was published in 2006. And his new book is a biography of Dwight Eisenhower in his years in the White House. And that's what it's called, Eisenhower, the White House Years, and it's published by Doubleday. I think that some people maybe would argue that one of the, in terms of long-lasting impact, one of the most important things that a president can do is to make nominations to the Supreme Court, something that occasionally gets attention, but maybe not as much as it should. And I'm sure that you would say that one in this vein, one of the most important things that Eisenhower did was to name Earl Warren to the court as a Chief Justice. This was in 1953. Perhaps you could talk some more about how that came about.
Yeah, certainly I would agree that in terms of the implications and historical significance of the Eisenhower years, the creation of the Warren Court is vital and somewhat inadvertent in certain ways. Eisenhower and Warren got to know each other a little bit in 1952. They were both candidates for the Republican nomination that year. Warren, a bit of a long-shot candidate. Eisenhower obviously secured the nomination. But they did get to know each other a little bit through the campaign that year. Eisenhower liked Warren very much. In some ways, they were similar. Both were internationalist Republicans. Both saw Taft as their principal adversary and therefore tended to see their opponents within the Republican Party as to their right. They were much more moderate on social issues and, as I say, internationalist in their foreign policy approach. Eisenhower initially considered Warren for his cabinet, thought about him as a possible Secretary of the Interior. Warren had some reluctance about it. Frankly, the money was important to Warren. Warren had a lot of children, and it was difficult for him to take what effectively would have been a pay cut. He was governor of California at the time. But ultimately, Warren agreed to serve as Solicitor General in the Eisenhower administration, and the idea there being that they would put him in the Solicitor Generalship, that he would sort of brush up his courtroom skills in that position, and then they would move him to the court when a vacancy occurred. Ike did promise him the first vacancy, as he said, to the Supreme Court. And so Warren accepted the Solicitor Generalship, but before it could even be announced, Chief Justice Vinson died. And at that point, Eisenhower hesitated. He did not believe that he had offered Warren the Chief Justiceship. He briefly considered elevating one of the existing justices and putting Warren in as an associate justice. That didn't seem to make sense. There were none of the justices who on the court at the time who Eisenhower felt he wanted to elevate to Chief Justice. Warren felt that he had a promise, and he held Ike to it. Anyway, after some negotiations back and forth, ultimately Ike did deliver on the promise and made Warren Chief Justice. That commenced a fairly rocky relationship between the two. I do think that Eisenhower, in one fundamental way, misjudged Warren. While it is true that they had certain things in common, and I just mentioned some of them, Warren came out of the progressive California Republican tradition, which is quite different than Eisenhower's sort of Eastern establishment Republican tradition. And one result, I think, is that the Warren Court, under Warren's leadership, did go off in directions that Eisenhower didn't anticipate and didn't always appreciate. Less, I think, in the area of civil rights than in the area where I think Eisenhower was most troubled, which is in domestic security. The Warren Court overturned a number of criminal convictions of communists based on their association rights to join the Communist Party. Eisenhower thought those were terribly misguided. At one point, fumed rather publicly, sort of semi-publicly, about how Warren was he lost confidence in Warren. There are a number of sort of unpleasant episodes between them. Warren, in retirement, asked Eisenhower what he would have done with the communists who came before the court, and Ike's response was that he would have shot them, which Warren said he regarded as merely petulant rather than definitive. So they had their differences. There's no question about it. But in terms of legacy, it's also true that the Warren Court was, in effect, created by Eisenhower, as I say, even inadvertently, and it went on to produce just landmark work in a variety of fields in American life.
All right, let's take another call. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Would you comment on Eisenhower's warning to the people that we must guard against the onslaught or usurpation of power by the a military-industrial complex, and now this is brought home by columnist George Will, who recently wrote an article about the headlines of U.S. defense budget really is beyond comprehension. And it's beyond comprehension, the gist of this article, is because it's unauditable. He cites two congressmen. Randy Forbes, a six-time Virginia Republican, said that none of the budget is even in a position to be audited. And let's see, Senator Tom Coburn, Republican of Oklahoma, said the Pentagon is one of the few agencies in the federal government that cannot produce auditable financial statements in accordance with the law. So this is an institution which is essential, but it's still contrary to the Democratic Republic.
Yeah. Well, that's that brings us back to one of the points made by that very first caller. I think that if there's anything that people are going to remember Eisenhower for, it's for his farewell address in which he uttered that now famous phrase about the military-industrial complex.
Indeed. Probably the most famous and important speech of Eisenhower's life. Well, first of all, let me just back up and say one of the most exciting pieces of research for me on the book was the exploration of that speech. I was working at the Eisenhower Library, where I spent much of the last 5 years, one afternoon when the deputy director came and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "We've got something I think you're going to be interested in." And it turned out they had just received six boxes of new material that had been lost for over 50 years related to the speech. They were stored in a boathouse up in Minnesota. The son of the principal author of the speech, Malcolm Moose, was the speechwriter who worked with Eisenhower on the speech. Moose, for whatever reason, had saved a few boxes that he had not shipped off to the library, and they had sat in storage for half a century. And when his son and daughter were cleaning out the boathouse at the end of the summer, they came upon the boxes and decided they would open them up and ship them off to the library. They contained more than two dozen new drafts of the speech that had never been read before, memos, all of the sort of preparation for the speech was in it. So it's a reminder that historical research is never quite over, and it was quite exciting to be able to delve into them. To the substance of the speech, yes, it was a richly considered, heavily edited, very deeply thought out speech. They worked on the idea for the speech, generated almost 2 years before the end of the presidency. There were, as I say, dozens of drafts. Ike personally edited several drafts. His brother, Milton, edited a draft. So he thought about this long and hard. And I left the country with a really deeply provocative and thought-provoking farewell, one that is resonant today, as your caller indicates. We continue to wrestle with the consequences of this complex. It's important to remember, too, Eisenhower was not saying in the speech that we should abolish the military-industrial complex, that we that there was something to be done to rid ourselves of it. His fundamental observation regarding this new phenomenon in American life was that when he grew up as a young West Point graduate, the country had time to react to conflict so that we could change industries that were devoted to civilian purposes and convert them to military enterprises, because it took weeks, months to build up to a war. In an era of nuclear weapons, and particularly nuclear missiles, that's no longer a luxury of American life. That at the close of the Eisenhower presidency, we needed to be ready to go to war in minutes' time, not weeks or months. And that resulted in a permanent armaments industry, as he described it. And that industry sought influence in Washington. It needed, in order for it to survive as an industry, it needed there to be a persistent need for weaponry. And that had created a new and ominous aspect of our politics. And that's what he was calling attention to, and did so quite vividly. I'll add one more thing on the speech, and then happy to take more questions on it, too. Mm-hmm. There is a second phenomenon that he identified in American culture that is less remarked on, but terribly important as well, and that's what he described as the rise of the scientific technological elite. I think because he described it as an elite rather than a complex, it seemed less foreboding or ominous. But his concern there was that government financing of research would tend to drive research in the direction of what government needed and wipe out the place of the solitary inventor, as he described him, as a generator of new ideas and entrepreneurialism. He was quite concerned about that, and I think rightly so. That's a harder phenomenon to measure because it's hard to know what research wasn't done. It's really measuring something in the negative as opposed to the positive. But it, too, has had a lasting impact on American life, and it, too, was something he was right to warn us about.
There's a story about this speech that I think has been kind of floating around for a long time, that Eisenhower intended also to include the Congress, and that at one point that he was going to call it the military-industrial congressional complex, and that then later drafts, the Congress ended up being cut out. And then I think other people have said, no, that's just a story. That was never going to be in there. Based on whatever material that you've seen, do you have any can you shed any light on that?
Yeah, the speechwriters who worked on the speech in later years said that, yes, that it was considered. It never made it into a draft, and that's why there's people on both sides of this question. When you read the drafts, you don't discover that phrase anywhere. But they say that there was discussion with Eisenhower about referring to it as the military-industrial congressional complex. And there is some sense to that, by the way, because part of the phenomenon that he was worried about was government officials who go off to work in the armaments industry and then lobby for increased military spending. And the people they're lobbying are members of Congress, by and large. So yes, there is some merit to that, and just intellectually sort of completing the thought. I suspect that the reason it never made it to a draft, and certainly the reason it didn't make it into the final speech, is that the other aspect of the speech is Ike is saying farewell. There is a sense of sort of wrapping up his service to his country in the speech. And among the people he's thanking for his associations is Congress. He was appointed, when he was sent to West Point, it was by congressional appointment. He had good relations with Congress during the war, and of course he'd worked closely with Congress during his presidency. So tonally, I think it would have been highly out of place to, on one hand, thank Congress for his long and generally positive relations with Congress, and then turn around and insert it into this this dangerous new force in American life. So it would have, just as a matter of rhetoric, I think, complicated the speech. So regardless of whether he believed that Congress belonged in that notion of the complex he was describing, it would have been just out of kilter with the rest of the speech.
Yeah. I have here an email. I want to make sure that we get in while there's still time. We have about 5-6 minutes. Someone is interested in having you talk about Eisenhower's feelings regarding Senator Joe McCarthy.
Mm-hmm. Another excellent question. Eisenhower was repelled by McCarthy, found him, as he referred to him, disgusting, and initially was at somewhat of a loss to know what to do about him. I mean, keep in mind, this is a man who came to the presidency from the military, where he issued an order, and it was obeyed, by and large. He had no power over McCarthy, by contrast. He couldn't stop him. He was a separately elected official, and Ike, of course, has no oversight authority over the Congress. So what he did, I think the book showed some new light on. At the time, it was regarded that he simply backed up and let McCarthy kind of run his own course. What it is clear from the records is that Ike was working quite assiduously behind the scenes to isolate McCarthy. He was meeting with newspaper publishers, with members of Congress, with captains of industry, and expressing to them his distaste for what McCarthy was up to, which then ultimately, when Ike did pull the trigger, so to speak, on McCarthy and invoked executive privilege and refused to let his subordinates testify before the McCarthy hearings about discussions they had with Eisenhower, which really is what began McCarthy's downfall in 54. By that time, he had already done such a good job of isolating McCarthy that that downfall, when it came very rapidly and very decisively. By the end of 54, McCarthy really is a spin phenomenon in American life, and that is largely due to Eisenhower's behind-the-scenes work to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. There's, I suppose, in addition to the military-industrial complex thing and maybe the his involvement in the little crisis, the Little Rock desegregation crisis. Maybe one other thing that people will associate with Eisenhower, and that is the interstate highway system of the country. Something that he, an idea that he really championed. That although I think technically speaking, when it was actually built, he wasn't president anymore. But perhaps if he hadn't put the idea out there, it wouldn't have happened. And that it was something that I think, though, for him had maybe his primary motivations here really did have to do, that had to do with national security, not so much, you know, people being able to pile in the car and go on vacation, but, you know, it had wide implications in terms of people's leisure time, in terms of commerce, maybe actually far beyond any kind of security implications.
Yeah, and in some ways I think the security argument for the interstate highway system was advanced to help it politically. It made it easier to get it through Congress. There was substantial opposition to it at the time, and it's an important reminder, I think, of the ways in which Eisenhower was not a doctrinaire or bound by either ideology or party. This is a giant investment in the American economy, and one that obviously came out of a very conservative, somewhat conservative presidency. He saw the implications of it. He'd seen the Autobahn in Germany, was impressed by it, was on the flip side very concerned by a tour he'd done of the United States between the wars, and was concerned about the lack of infrastructure in this country. And so, yes, despite considerable opposition, did ultimately secure passage of the system. The very early pieces of it were constructed in his presidency, but the completion of the system came about later.
Mm, all right. We're coming down to the point where we have a couple of minutes left. I think our first caller, maybe we'd like to get back with us for another comment. We'll do that. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I had a follow-up on what we were talking about earlier, but I was wondering whether you had comments about the Suez Crisis, basically pulling France, Britain, and Israel back. That's pretty dramatic, and it doesn't really get commented on much. I wonder whether you found anything new or different on it, and maybe I'm not even right. That was Eisenhower, wasn't it?
Yes, 1956. The Suez Crisis and the Hungarian Crisis, when the Soviets invaded Hungary, occurred within the same month and just weeks before the 1956 election. It's an unbelievably tumultuous period in American history, and it sort of goes back to your initial point about the period, I think, being misunderstood. Eisenhower was furious with the British and French and Israelis for plotting the Suez Crisis without including the United States in any of its planning. The United States was deliberately shut out of those plans because the British in particular were concerned that the United States wouldn't support the effort. And when push came to shove, to the amazement really of Egypt and much of the Third World, Eisenhower sided with Egypt after the invasion, and worked very hard and ultimately successfully to force the withdrawal of British, French, and Israeli forces from Egypt, which they had seized the Suez on the pretext that Nasser was nationalizing the canal, but really because the British wanted to retain control of it.
Mm. One thing, again, I appreciate the callers for his comments. As we're down here for the last couple of minutes, one thing that I mentioned earlier and I want to get back to, and maybe you can at least talk about for a minute or so, is the relationship between Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, and particularly why it is that when it came time to choose a running mate, why it is that Eisenhower chose Nixon.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, a hard topic to package into a couple of minutes. His relationship with Nixon was very complicated, as many people's relationship with Nixon was. Eisenhower, in 52, did not play a terribly active role in the selection of his vice president, although he did approve Nixon's nomination. As we talked about earlier, his age was an issue. Nixon was much younger and seen as a sort of a vital part of the ticket. Nixon came from California, and it was useful that he could help carry California. So there were a number of political calculations. Nixon also seen as much more fervently anti-communist than Eisenhower, and as I mentioned, Eisenhower was running as a moderate. Nixon helped him with conservatives. So in all of those ways, Nixon made a certain amount of sense politically. What that commenced was a very complicated relationship between them. Eisenhower, his advisors actually, at one point, some of his advisors urged dumping Nixon from the ticket in 52 after the so-called slush fund scandal. Nixon gave his famous Checker speech when he said that he wasn't going to give back Checkers, the puppy that had been given to his daughters. He refused to give it back. And there was a great national outcry about it, and Nixon sort of retained his place on the ticket as a result. But even then, when Eisenhower traveled to West Virginia to let Nixon know that he was keeping him on the ticket, Nixon looked up, sort of startled on his plane, to see Eisenhower suddenly next to him. And he said that he was sort of surprised and said, "Well, you're here, General." And he said, "Well, of course I'm here. You're my boy." And I think that statement, "You're my boy," captures a kind of fundamental aspect of their relationship, which is this paternalism. I never saw Nixon as an equal. He had great regard for his skill and his loyalty. Nixon performed quite admirably in the wake of Ike's heart attack. And yet Ike in 56 considered again dropping Nixon from the ticket in favor of, he actually considered running with a Democrat in 56, which would have been astonishing. But he felt Nixon would have benefited by running one of the major departments rather than serving as his understudy. And Nixon again fought his way back onto the ticket. But there is, throughout their relationship, a sense of inequality, and that was true from the beginning, and it was true right to the end.
There we must leave it. Our guest, Jim Newton, he is editor-at-large at the Los Angeles Times, where he writes a weekly column. He is author also of the recently published book, Eisenhower, the White House Years, published by Doubleday. And Mr. Newton, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being with you.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
This morning in Focus, we're doing two archives. This first show that you've been listening to about Eisenhower and his presidency was from January of this year. We will, in the second hour, reach back to November of last year for a conversation that I had with anti-corruption activist Andrew Feinstein. And we were talking about a book that he's written that's titled The Shadow World, and it's about the international arms trade. It's estimated that in the year 2010, governments around the world spent $1.6 trillion on weapons. That's $235 for every person on the planet. Feinstein says this spending has some profound impacts. It fuels conflict, it erodes democracy, and siphons off money that might otherwise be channeled into development. So we explore in this conversation some of the formal and also gray markets of the global arms trade, and you can hear that in the second hour of the show today. We'll be live here tomorrow in the first part of the program talking with Eric Swingadow. He's professor of geography at the University of Manchester. He'll be here in our area to give a talk in the MillerCom series talking about some of the relationships between politics and political protest and the urban spaces where they take place, places like, for example, Tahrir Square. He'll be giving a talk on this on the U of I campus tomorrow afternoon, and we'll chat with us, share some of those ideas in the morning. Also tomorrow, we'll be doing our regular monthly program on computers. Celeste Quinn is the host for that show, and her guests will be Debbie Flieger and Jim Eyrick. Debbie is a network engineer with Sites, and Jim Eyrick is now working with the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. And this is something that we do every month on the show, and the idea is if you have a computer problem, it's not working, it's not doing what you need it to do, this is your chance to call in, explain the problem, and get some expert advice. And I think in the past on these shows, they've always been very helpful. So that's tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. Then on Friday at 11, we'll do our monthly show on dog care and dog behavior. Celeste will also be hosting that program, and her guests will be dog trainers Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel. You can find out what we'll be doing in the days ahead. You can also listen to past programs by going to our website, and that is WILL.illinois.edu. Well, we'll take a break, as we usually do at this point, so we can bring you an update on the commodity markets and some news from National Public Radio, so stay tuned.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to experience the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra and Choir on Thursday, March 8th. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Soybean futures have climbed to fresh 5 months highs and appear headed for their biggest monthly gain in more than a year, bolstered by growing export demand and investment fund buying. Soybeans holding on to the gains at mid-session after trading both positive and negative territory earlier this morning. And that in turn might be helping corn and wheat futures, as well as corn futures now in positive territory as well. USDA earlier today saying that U.S. exporters sold 285,000 tons of U.S. soybeans to China. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars then. In Kansas City, March, we traded